Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I am proud to bring you ComWest Speaks. And now, without further words, I will introduce Setna ComWest, Egyptian High Priest. Greetings and welcome, Setna. How are you?
Hanku Jat Senev, life, health, and prosperity to all. I am Setna ComWest, and I am well. Welcome, Hercules.
Thank you very much. I'm very much looking forward to tonight's show, as the topic is Osiris and the Egyptian Resurrection.
We know that in the Christian faith and in the Hebrew faith, that these are days of high holidays, and they are also in high holidays in Kemet in Egypt. The Hebrews say that they have taken themselves out of Egypt, so mote it be, on this holiday. I am speaking to the rebirth and recreation of Osiris, which also took place at this point in the early spring. Isis found, as she flew all over the Egyptian region or country, the pieces that Set had cut up Osiris into, 14 pieces. And then she couldn't find a certain one, which she carved into something else.
Okay.
She fused by her magic the body of Osiris back together again, and she wrapped it in linen strips. This is what is the beginning, they say, of the original, that Osiris was the first mummy. But instead of waiting for afterlife, she brought him back to life. And slowly he began to open his eyes and move and realize his beautiful wife was standing beside him. And she used the words of power, and she gave his heart to beat, and she made his life back where it was. And they fell in love again, and they made love. And through their union came Horus. And as she moved herself from Osiris's body, he disappeared. He became the lord of the afterworld. And she, instead of being pregnant for 9 months, they say within 3 or 4 hours, Horus was born. So from his seed came the great Horus. And Osiris became the lord of the underworld. And Horus was born, and in him was the spirit of Osiris reborn. And so in the traditions of Kemet, every day, when a pharaoh comes to the temple, he is Horus, and he is reborn as Horus, the sun god. And he comes, and he blesses the entire nation, and he does that for the entirety of his reign. Upon his death, physical death, the pharaoh becomes Osiris and enters into the next world, the eternal world. You call them in Greece the Elysian Fields.
Mm-hmm.
Some Greek traditions say Hades, and that it's a land of shadows. And I've read very sad, sad things from the River of Styx, guarded by a three-headed monster dog, and that no one can leave. Well, as we know, Orpheus tried to do that and to get Eurydice, and that didn't go too well, did it, Hercules?
Not in the long run, no, because he didn't trust.
Well, and she also really was in love with Hades, I believe, and she didn't want to leave. So she put the doubt into his head, and when he turned around, back she was with Hades. And Persephone was nowhere to be seen, I imagine, though it was a spring. In any case, so we have every Egyptian in his life takes on the body, soul, the energy, the embodiment of Osiris, be he a sand worker, a farmer, a fisherman, a noble, or a pharaoh, or priest. And I say it that way because in some ways the priests were higher than the royalty. They were higher than they were on a separate plane, a separate level than the royalty, who were considered divine, but also, which is strange, divine and mortal at the same time. the priests and priestesses of the gods of Egypt were sort of an intermediary. They were not divine, but they were not completely mortal. And I know, Hercules, you understand what I'm saying here.
Yes,
and I hope those of you that are listening understand. There was a connection between the gods and the goddesses, the Nitaru of Egypt, and the priesthood and the royalty. King was a man and was worshipped as pharaoh. I should say respected as a pharaoh. I don't want to say worshipped, although history records that they were worshipped as gods. But this is only the embodiment of the deity. The pharaoh himself was known to be human, known to be mortal. I want to get that clear. The Egyptians didn't think their pharaoh was a god. They thought he was the representative of the god. The only pharaoh that actually had the audacity to call himself the actual god was Akhenaten. Because sticks in my mouth, I can't stand him. It's been 4,000 years, Hercules, and I still don't forgive him. It's terrible. Well, you know me. I'm not gonna be serious. I can be oh serious, but I'm not gonna be completely serious. I know I punned, but what can you do? Akhenaten, who was Amenhotep IV, and his beautiful wife Nefertiti. Her real name was Neferu Nefertiti, which means a beautiful woman has come. That was her title, not her real name. We don't really know her real name. It was never written anywhere. Akhenaten decided when he became ill. It's a lot like Caligula. When he became ill, he suddenly became a god. Caligula did the same thing. And Akhenaten said to the entire nation of Egypt, you don't worship the gods yourself, and there is only one god now. You worship all the other deities all these decades and centuries, and I'm throwing all that out. I have decided, since I am pharaoh and I'm all-powerful and I am omnipotent, that you will all worship me. And I and Nefertiti will be your gods, and also the arbiter to the other god, Aten, our god, the solar disk. And you will worship me, and I will then worship for you. How's that for nerve? This pharaoh took all the priests and priestesses and musicians and artisans and did not worship what he said and had them all killed. We have found mass graves in El Armana, which is his city that he built, and outside of Thebes that date back to 1350 BC, because this particular pharaoh would not have people not work. So he was kind of the Jim Jones of Egypt. That's how I look at him, because eventually the Egyptians rose up and killed him. And some people in my world say, good. I don't know. I think that he was misguided and felt that he was the only one. We've heard this throughout history, haven't we? Mentioned Caligula. There have been so many people, including this Jim Jones and Hale Bopp and all these other people, that thought they were God. Well, it is possible, if we go back, that Osiris, Isis, Set, and Nephthys were people originally before they were deified. And I believe this. We also talked, Hercules, you and I recently, and a consortium, that the deities of Egypt and Greece and Rome and such may have been extraterrestrial. We'll get to that in another time, but it is my belief that that is true, and that the Egyptian spirits, gods, goddesses, hail originally from the area of the solar system around the planet, the star Sirius, the North Star. Isis is called Isis Sotis, Aset Sotis, which is Isis, the North Star, the dog star. And they say that is why she asked her sister to be with Osiris, and he produced Anubis, and Apuat, his twin brother, the silver and black jackal-headed deities you'll see in many, many temples. As Osiris resurrected into the form of the Lord of the afterworld, he took a royal court with him, which were behind Nitaru. He took Horus, who is the lord of the physical plane, and when the time comes for someone to pass over, they are brought to, the soul is brought first from the living plane into the halfway life, and they meet Anubis. Anubis is the guardian of the souls, and his brother, Apuat, who is the exact clone, only in silver rather than black, walks with them from the physical plane. I call this that tunnel effect, the light in the tunnel, and it's what they see. You come to the end of the tunnel, and you have the two dogs waiting, the two guardians, and they take your hand, and you'll go through 12 hours of day and 12 hours of night, and you will be judged by all sorts of lesser demigods and deities. You have them in Greece too, little demigods and things that will do all kinds of things. There's a lady of fire. There is the lord of the hard waters. There is a king or queen of stone. And they will ask the soul all sorts of crazy questions, and you must know the answer. Now, the Egyptians tried to cheat this by wearing a heart scarab. The scarab was supposed to be like if you were shooting Superman and the bullets would bounce off his chest. If you were shooting these crazy answers and things that could hurt the person, the scarab was supposed to protect them from that. And it would, you know, the scarab would answer for you.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't know. The first time in history I know that a bug would actually help you. The scarab, you know, they're dung beetles. They're not exactly, I mean, they couldn't pick a butterfly. They couldn't pick anything cute. They had to have a dung beetle. But a dung beetle represents Khafre, which is the lord also of resurrection. They saw the beetle rolling around a ball of camel dung, usually. And out of that dung came hundreds of little baby scarabs. And so they thought that was magical, of course. They didn't know, I don't know where that came from, but they thought that Khafre then was to keep the bringer of the soul to the, you know, into the internet, the into the eternal. I almost said international. Well, these days, yes. Your soul hopefully didn't have to go through customs. However, these 12 hours of the day and night are kind of like going through customs. Anubis and Anpuat would carry those people forward. And then what stood before them after that, you think you're already clear, right? Wrong. Before you can reach the high throne of Osiris, you're standing online, kind of like you would be doing, you know, in Kmart or Walmart or what have you, and you're waiting to get spoken to. And what happens is you see before you the Lord Tehute, who is Thoth, the ibis-headed god, who is the scribe of all the gods. He's kind of Mercury or Hermes in Egypt. In fact, he's called Hermes Trismegistus, Hermes three times greatest.
Christ.
I'm pronouncing that correctly, Trismegistus.
Trismegistus.
Well, you would do it right because you're Greek and you speak Greek. You know, it's all Greek to me. So. Anyway, oh God, I'm going to get in trouble. Anyway, you're greeted by, and he says your name. And you, whatever, you go on and on and on. And then there's questions. It's called the negative confession. Very much like the Ten Commandments, but they have like 100.
Oh, wow.
It's really 40 questions. Did you do this? Did you do that? Were you here? Were you there? I didn't do this. I did that. I didn't do all these things. Where in the Ten Commandments it's thou shalt not. In the 40 negative confessions, I did not, but I did do this. And you have to you said all these things. Hopefully the scarab is still protecting you, but now comes a real tricky part. They come and you're holding in your hand, and this is kind of strange, your beating heart. In a, you think it's on your sleeve, but it's in a silver plate here. And the heart is on a silver plate. And Thoth takes the heart from the person, the high king, queen, farm worker, whoever it is. And they bring the heart to the goddess Maat. Maat is justice and truth And not the American way. They hadn't happened yet, okay? sorry, I had to. they bring the heart, and then she takes from her crown a beautiful white carved ostrich plume. It's split in half. And it's called the feather of truth. And it's a feather, so it's quite light, you know. So they lay the feather of truth into one of the two little cups on top of the scale. And the next thing that happens is that the heart is taken. Give me a moment.
Sure.
The high priest is burning way too much incense. And it's making me choke. Well, this is a high holy day, and if you could see my altar, I have the Lady Aset Isis, my candles, all of my Niteru surrounding me. It's very powerful in here. And my green, I have a beautiful green obsidian egg, which represents Osiris. He's hatching. Ta-da! And I make that happen. So you've got the heart and the feather on the scales. And Ma'at is pushing the weights and things so that you see that the heart and the heart must be lighter or equal to the feather. If the heart, with a heavy heart, the heart is taken off the tray, and there is this thing. I don't know. I think Stephen King was an Egyptian because there's a deity, a demon. Its name is Amut or Amit. And Amit is a horrible creature. It's part hippopotamus, the middle quarter of a lion, and the head of a crocodile.
Wow.
Lovely, just lovely creature. The word ugly was happened after this thing was created, I think. Anyway, if your heart is heavy, you have a heavy heart, and you have all this sin and negative energy, and you're just downright miserable, they take the heart. And literally, Amut eats your heart out. And as this creature finishes devouring the heart, the soul disappears. Egyptians don't believe in hell, but they do believe in oblivion. The entire being just vanishes, poof, gone. And I've seen this in visions where a man and his wife were in a car accident, and they've gone to the Great Hall, and he was cheating on his wife, and she was a good and noble wife. And she's standing there holding her husband, his arm, and she's, you know, Murray, everything, you know, is going to, and all of a sudden, poof, he's gone. And she goes on to paradise, into the high Elysian fields, into the next life. There's a palace for her. She sees where she can see in a mirror called the Mirror of Hathor. She can see what's going on in the living world. And she can come from her tomb in Egypt and possibly here. We don't know yet if there is a door. And she comes through the door and can actually answer questions and help out those who are in the physical plane. We call these people ghosts, don't we, Hercules? And they're able to help out. They come and, you know, we as a culture have gotten afraid of spirits, well, not lately, but now, but most of the time, in the 20th century, it was kind of ignored, all these things, but the people didn't see that their ancestors could help them. In India, in China, in Africa, in ancient England, in Greece, in Rome, as far as we know, in the Native American cultures, there was ancestor worship, that the ancestors were brought. In Peru, for instance, the ancestors, this is kind of grisly, the ancestors were mummified, and they were taken out of their tombs every time there was a major event. You had the mummified ancestors, you know, here Uncle Micmac, who's been around for, you know, 500 years, and he's now a rock with a hat on and maybe a blanket and what have you. He's there at the party. And he's supposed to help give answers and questions. And going back to Egypt, because I think I should do that, there's a spirit door. And through that door, the soul, is supposed to come through and be able to come to speak to the people and give them answers and comfort. And like modern people come, many people come to the cemetery, particularly this time of the year,
mm-hmm.
and they bring flowers and they sit by the grave of their family. And they'll talk to, you know, grandpa, grandma. Well, this tradition is the way it was in Egypt, that people actually in front of the tombs, in front of the spirit door, had, you know, a picnic or a party, and they included the ancestor. And they say that this goes back to Osiris, and that Isis would summon, instead of being a wooden or a plaster door, Isis created a magical portal where she and Horus, her grandchildren, the four sons of Horus, and his wife, her daughter-in-law, Hathor, Heheru, could all walk through that door and be with Osiris on the other side. And more powerful, because after all, Isis is the, in my mind, and in many, many other people's opinion, the greatest enchantress of all times, the greatest wizard, high priestess, witch there's ever been. And Isis was able to transmute the worlds. She could go from the living to the dead, to the future, to the past. Isis says, I am, I was, and I shall always be, and I am without end. And she was basically the prototype for Mary, and we all know that many people have had miracles with the Virgin Mary appearing in various different places. I live in Newark, New Jersey. There's a large Portuguese population here, and they are very, very, very faithful to Our Lady of Fatima. And she appeared to these two children, and they, you know, they were prophets. They were giving predictions and things that the Virgin Mary spoke to them. And many of these things, many, many of them were accurate and came true. This is true in Egypt, in the temple at Philae, and also in the temple at Aswan. People came to the oracles of Isis, and in Abydos, they came to the oracles of Osiris. Further down, I will say Upper Egypt, you know, Egypt is backwards, so the south is the north. In Upper Egypt, which is in the south of Egypt, people, Alexander the Great, for instance, went to the great temple of Karnak, the temple of Amun-Ra. In his case, they called it Zeus Amun by then, because that was what was happening. They took the Greeks and the Egyptian and brought them together, which I kind of approve of. And they hailed him, the son of Zeus. You had competition there, Hercules. Alexander the Great was another one of Zeus's, you'll forgive me for saying, but dirt, because you weren't Herod's kid. So they, you know, Alexander then made himself, and people don't know this either, Alexander then went back to Thebes, which is where Karnak is, and he was crowned Pharaoh of Egypt, the first Ptolemaic ruler, the first ruler, Macedonian ruler of Egypt, was not Ptolemy the First. It was Alexander the Great himself. And then he, because he wanted to go on conquering, took the pharaoh's crown and crowned Ptolemy, and made Ptolemy the First Ptolemy the pharaoh of Egypt, and decided, and created that whole dynasty. But that didn't happen until they came back from India. And you know, there was a coalition that had had enough of Alexander's nonsense. They all wanted to go home. They hadn't been home in, I think it was, 7 to 9 years? And they hadn't seen their wives or their kids. 9 years?
I don't remember the exact amount, but I know it was for many years, and they'd wanted to go back, and they were getting grumbly and rebellious.
Kind of like Odysseus and his crew. Of course, you know, Alexander didn't hang out with Circe, you know, and the Amazons, which they all had fun with. But they wanted to go home, and they had had enough. And it's been suggested that when they went back to, on the way back to Persia, on the way back to the city of Babylon, that he was poisoned. Right after that, his wife was Roxana was killed, their child was killed, and they did away with his mother, Olympia. And someone else came to rule. And all of the other people scattered, all his generals all scattered. And as we know, Ptolemy then took Alexander's body, because that means he was the big mucky muck, and he took the body and he buried Alexander in a luxurious tomb, crystal tomb, in out just outside of Alexandria. And apparently for hundreds and hundreds of years, it was a tourist attraction. People came to see the tomb of including Julius Caesar. Cleopatra, he had gone before that with her father, Ptolemy Auletes. That's how you pronounce that? That's flute player.
I don't remember. I need to see the word written, and then I could tell you.
Okay, well, his nickname was flute player or fluter. I was told it was Auletes. And he also brought Julius Caesar and Pompey and many others to the great tomb of Alexander, which was gold and marble and clear quartz crystal. And kind of like the Ark of the Covenant, this tomb was said to have enormous psychic powers, magical powers, and curative, and like many other things that saints, they considered Alexander a god and a saint, a person worthy of much worship and adoration. But this all stems, and I keep going back in circles, but it's good. This all stems from Osiris, because his tomb, which was in Abydos, a humongous temple that there was a archaeologist, Egyptologist, her nickname was Om Seti, which is the mother of Seti. She restored the beautiful funerary temple, mortuary temple of Seti, Pharaoh Ramses II's father, and also the great, great temple of Abydos in Abydos, the temple of Osiris. The ironic thing, and to this day I don't understand it, in the Louvre, the hypostyle, the inner shrine of Osiris containing his quote-unquote backbone, they say, is in the Louvre.
Mm.
Like the Elgin marbles and like many other things that are magical, these belong back where they're from. I believe strongly that the Elgin marbles, there was a curse put on them that if they were removed, that bad things, and look what happened to England. We had wars, we've had pestilence, we've had all kinds of things since they've been removed. The same thing happened with Paris. When that shrine was removed, we had the French Revolution happen. Hello. The king and queen were murdered. Yeah, Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI, and they don't know whatever happened to the Dauphin, his son. But I believe that curse also affected them by desecrating the tomb of Osiris. But they said for centuries that if you went to this temple at Abydos and you were grieving over the loss of your family or what have you, that you could go there, Osiris would answer for you. Now, like a lot of relics, which are quote-unquote fake, the Egyptians had a thing that they did, which I don't like, but I'm going to bring up. And it happened to Alexander. In fact, it happened incorrectly. They had statues where the mouth could move.
Did so animatronics?
Alexander, yeah. But the voice was a priest off in the distance somewhere. And that's what happened to Alexander. They called him the great pharaoh, blah, master, what have you. But he misheard things. And so he was told, or he said, well, I am now the son of Zeus, and I am an Amon. I am the pharaoh. Well, they weren't going to argue with him. He had a 10,000 troop army, you know, there with legions and on and on. I don't think they're going to say, well, we kind of made a mistake. That didn't happen very well. And so Julius Caesar went to the temple of Abydos with his people. This is before he conquered Egypt with Cleopatra. He conquered it because she was not a real queen in the sense of a queen. She was a vassal, a puppet. Her father was, and she was. They were owned by Rome by then. So he went down after they restored her father to the throne. And he went to the temple of Osiris, and he asked what would happen. And they told him that he would be a great conqueror and a great lord. Well, and he was looking at the statue, watching its mouth move. And he wanted to see what was behind, you know, behind curtain number two. And they wouldn't let him back there. They said, no, it's forbidden. And being a very superstitious man, Caesar said, fine. And I'm sure the priest went, oh, my God, thank goodness. Because here he would have seen the whole works, and that's not good. You had those things happening in Greece also, did you not?
Yes. All that befell Egypt also befell Greece.
Where I know, I told you, my sister's past life, one of them is a Delphic oracle, Apithia.
Yeah.
The same kind of thing at Delphi, the temple of Apollo, where they had predictions, because they say that Apollo slew the python called Pythos, and put it under the gases, the methane gases that the oracle was chewing laurel leaves, which are poisonous, and sniffing methane gas and got high as a kite and made all her predictions. And they even befell
That's a little bit of an exaggeration. There were gases and there were the laurel leaves, but the pythoness spoke in a tongue that only the priests could interpret. And often the sayings were enigmatic. Like this one in ancient Greece, it's ixis afixis ukenton polemon snixis. And depending on where you put the comma, and they didn't put the comma, it's go to war not, for you shall perish, or go to war, for surely you will not perish. And just by changing the comma around, it can mean something very different. So there were very puzzling prophecies given, and people from all around the Mediterranean would go there and consult the oracle, and it was a very rich temple because they left lots of gifts.
I know that the Delphic oracle, the words Delphic utterance after a while meant possibly two meanings. And I know that came that about that way. But also, didn't Pericles go there and ask about, or maybe it was another one of the Greeks, about rescuing Athens and that it would be protected by its high wooden walls, and they meant the ships.
Yes, you could interpret the prophecy in different ways because, again, they didn't punctuate it. Whatever happened, they were right in many cases.
Well, that's exactly the case, and it's exactly the same case with the priests and priestesses of Osiris. There was a priestess who's called a Chantress, and she holds a sistrum, and she has in her hands other amulets and charms, and a rattle called Amenyet, which is also associated with the goddess Hathor. It's an Egyptian collar that's actually a rattle. And because it was used and it gave off a strange fragrance and scent, and again, she spoke in tongues, this priestess. And again, she was interpreted by the priests of Osiris.
Yes.
And her predictions were very, very accurate, frightening sometimes. They told Ramesses II, like you say, not to go to war. And he did with the Hittites. And as I told you when we met, that it was a draw. And that Ramesses bragged on his temple at Abu Simbel that he beat the hell out of them. And that's not true. It was a draw. The king of the Hittites also did the same thing. And his tomb, that he conquered Pharaoh Ramesses and humbled him. So neither of them, they were both big braggadocios, and neither one was going to back down. But they remained allies even through all of the dynastic periods from that time on. Whenever either one of them was in trouble, they would yell for help. The most famous group of that coalition would be during the time of the Queen of Sheba and Solomon. They were all ganging up on everybody to conquer everything. And as you know, they were all going to give money and arms and what have you. And the Queen of Sheba said that she could conquer Solomon by her charms and her beauty. And that worked for a while.
Yes.
But then Solomon, being the wizard, and he was a sorcerer, Solomon doing the magic, he just saw right through her, and they sent her packing. However, she was packing with a baby. And the first rulers of Ethiopia that were Jewish rulers of Ethiopia came as from the son who were was the son of Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. And that's kind of interesting. And they moved, and later they say that the Ark of the Covenant to this day rests in Ethiopia. No one can actually confirm that because the priests that protect it will not confirm or deny it. There's a temple. It's built the way prescribed in the Old Testament, in the Torah, that says how that's to be presented. And there's a place that no one's allowed to go to. So I believe it's actually there. You know, the whole thing that the Knights Temple is taking it and what have you, I don't know about that. But I do know that it is probably in Ethiopia. And to go back to where I was going, I do jump up on tangents, but it's all about answering questions and things.
Yes.
During the time later on in the early and late dynastic, after the dynastic, when the Romans came and they took over Egypt, the Temple of Osiris became, again, a tourist attraction. Many of the other temples went into ruin. The Temple of Isis, the Temple of Bast, those and a few others became, and the library, came into tourist attractions. Oddly enough, people go on and on about the pyramids. They were pretty much covered with sand by then. The Sphinx was up to its neck. And when Napoleon came to it later, it was, you know, a mess. So were the pyramids, and so were a lot of the other temples. The Sahara is not a kind place. The sandstorms happen. They've covered ruins for hundreds of thousands of years. So a lot of what was beautiful and splendid and what have you was covered and destroyed by the sands of Egypt. It's the sands of the Sahara itself. Amun Seti came in the 1930s. She started her working, or early, maybe the 40s. She came probably after World War II. She came and she saw parts of the Temple of Osiris and the Temple of Seti. And she saw them sticking out of the sand, and she wanted to see what she could do. And then also, one of the bad things is that the Romans used to take pieces out of one temple to build something else. Many, mm-hmm. many of the pieces of Akhenaten's solar temples in Akhenaten, which was the city, found themselves in as rubble and as fill in other parts that they were rebuilding, protecting the temple of Thebes, the temple of Karnak. The Romans also used that as a temple of Jupiter. And then later it became a church, which, you know, as different religions came, you'll find crosses on there and Christian symbols. And later also, it's also a mosque now. Parts of it are a mosque. So as the world progresses, that temple is still a very powerful, very live temple. And it's been around for 1,000 years. Before it was actually built as a structure, that temple was, there is a, like the Temple of the Rock in Mecca, the sacred stones. There is a place in that where the temple is, that is supposedly where the gods and goddesses could enter and leave. The vortex place is what they call it. We were going back talking about the aliens, and this is what I was talking about before about Isis being able to have this vortex, this magical door that she could create where people could come and go. I believe there is a place on Mount Olympus that you can't go to that is supposed to be the same kind of thing. Do you know what I'm talking about, Hercules?
No.
Well, I was told, I have many other Greek friends, and they said they think it's an entrance on Mount Olympus somewhere. It's like a cave that you're not allowed to go into, but it's supposed to be the entrance down into the river Styx.
I never heard on Mount Olympus. I know that the during the labors of Hercules, he went into the underworld in Peloponnesus, and there everyone knows where it is. They used to put necromandia or oracles of the dead near the entrances to the underworld. But I never heard on top of Olympus, because that would be in the realm of the air. Where's the under?
Well, not on top of, it's not on top, according to people that I've spoken to, it's not on top of the mountain. It's somewhere below, like a cave, in like the middle. You'd have to walk up to it, and then there's a cavern, a cracky cavern. It's very hard to get into and very hard to get out of, that they don't want you to touch or get near. So, you know, this could be inaccurate, I don't know, but I'm telling you, like Herodotus, something that I had heard, and that's how he worked. He had heard many things,
yes.
And he traveled all over the place. He must have had an amazing guide travel book, you know. He was an amazing man. He was all over the ancient world.
And tourism, you're very right. I know that a Lemnian in antiquity wrote a tour guide to Troy, which was still, like, it was visited like we visit Harrisburg or Gettysburg in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So people used to go to Troy on vacations, and it was very touristy. They had all sorts of souvenirs to bring back, and they had all sorts of establishments where you could stay, and they had tours and the whole thing. So there was a lot of tourism in the ancient world, and a lot of quote-unquote lost sites weren't lost at all to the ancients. They became lost later on to those who carried away the Elgin marbles and things like that.
Well, like, for instance, in the 18th dynasty, Thutmose III he fell asleep between the two paws of the Sphinx. There's a stele that talks about this, right between the Sphinx paws. This is probably, I would say, 1400 BC,
mm-hmm.
because he's two or three pharaohs before Akhenaten. And the Sphinx said, "Listen, Thutmose, wake up." And he's like, "Huh?" You know. And they said, "If you clear the sand away from the Sphinx, I will make you pharaoh." Well, his I guess she was his aunt and sister, because they were very incestuous, the Egyptians. So she was his aunt and his sister and his stepmother, all in one. She was ruling. That's Hatshepsut, one of my favorite pharaohs. Egypt prospered greatly under her. And he was a younger man, and she took over as co-regent. But what happened was she decided, I'm going to be pharaoh. And she was for about 25 years. She was, and Egypt did very well under her. Well, he grew up and he says, "Look, I'm supposed to be the king, not you." She wasn't the queen of Egypt. She was a pharaoh. She was the king. So he didn't like that. And frankly, the male-dominated society of the royalty said, "I don't think so." And I really believe that, and I said this to you, that they got rid of her. She had a palace west of the Thebes, and I really think that they took her out and just said, "Go there." Her lover's name was Senmut. He built that magnificent mortuary temple of hers. It's still one of the most beautiful temples in the world, and they did away with him. And then they say Thutmose III married her daughter, and then after a while she kind of vanished too. But the point is that he restored a tourist attraction, the Sphinx and the pyramids. He had them all cleared. And as you said, it became a very big thing. I'm sure they had, you know, little souvenir vendors or what have you all around there. And there is a stele that says, that relates the story I just did about the Sphinx talking to the pharaoh. And the reason I mentioned the Sphinx also is the Sphinx, they say, is an embodiment of the spirit of Horus. That it is one of the spirit animals that he turns into. Like his father Osiris can become a griffin or a cobra, he becomes a ram-headed god. They all have many shape-shifting forms.
Yes.
Isis can become a bird called a kite. She's been known to be a cow, like her sister. I don't know what that is. The daughter-in-law Hathor is a cow, and Isis is considered a cow. So I often wonder if they're a similar deity, if they're really the same being put into two different aspects. It's possible.
But
they're very, very, yes, it's also said that Hathor, in some cases, is also considered Horus's mom. But as I told you, there's two Horuses and two Hathors. There is one Osiris. However, in the beginning of his worship in pre-dynastic times, he is green because he's a vegetation god. He becomes the god of civilization and of what is proper and government and all these other things. But originally, every spring, and this is where we get the resurrection, every spring they would plant and put an image of Osiris into the farmland, and he would rise up, kind of like the great pumpkin. He would rise up, and they would have these huge, huge fertility festivals. The Lord Osiris is reborn, is risen. And that's around this time of the year, and that's where we started. You have that resurrection, and then you have later the resurrection from being mutilated and dismantled and re-put back together, reassembled, and he is reborn that way. So this Lord, this Egyptian deity, has always been a god of resurrection and reincarnation. And his son Horus carried that through. Horus is immortal because he, unlike other gods and goddesses, he didn't die. He's with us. Every time a pharaoh or a ruler is born, he becomes Horus. And as he passes, he passes into Osiris. As we are children of the sun, and Osiris is a lord of the moon also, an odd thing. In your traditions, in Greek traditions, the moon is Selene. Artemis and Diana, right. There's
Diana,
always the lunar goddesses. So it's funny. Like I say often, the Egyptians did a lot of things backwards, and that's the same thing. The lord of the moon is Khonsu. He's Khensu. He's Osiris, also called Osiris Saker. He is a falcon-headed god wearing the half moon on his head and a solar disk within that, making the completion of the lunar cycles. This lord is worshipped this way as the moon rises every month. It rises and falls, just as the sun sets and rises every day. The moon in Egypt and in the world rises and sets every month. So it's kind of an interesting thing. So he's reborn too every month. Just as Ra is reborn and Horus is reborn every day.
Yeah, Hercules and the other sun gods in antiquity, although they didn't have as colorful a journey as the Egyptian gods, they also, the sun, whether it be Helios or Apollo or Hyperion or Hercules or any one of the other solar avatars, they traveled across the sky and then they set down their chariot at the lands of the sunset. And there their kingdom was. In the morning, they rode the chariot again, and the journey repeated.
So just as last Sunday in the Christian world, last Sunday was Palm Sunday. In Egypt, the resurrection, the Egyptians would cut pieces of papyrus and lotus and carry them through the streets, saying that the Lord has risen. There was a reincarnation. The lotus blossom they had them just as they were going to open, and they would carry them. The women carried the lotus blossoms, and the men carried papyrus stalks, and they would carry them through the streets in celebration of the resurrection of their high lord. This is exactly the same thing in a similar situation that happened Palm Sunday. The Lord is, you know, Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem, where they had all the palms and they were celebrating him and throwing flowers and palm fronds and, you know, in adoration of the bringing in of the Lord. They didn't know, none of them knew, the dire, horrible things that were going to happen in the next week. And I often wondered, was it a week or a month or, you know, did we as a people then make that a week? I don't know. I can't say. I wasn't alive in that period, but it seems to me that's, you know, he had 5 days Passover, which was the Passover, and then all of a sudden he was betrayed tonight on Thursday, and then, of course, crucified the next day. So Osiris didn't have that, the negativity that happened with his disciples, but he did have his brother, didn't he? And yes. the brother was a literal cut up. He cut up Osiris into 14 pieces. And, you know, as I said, in their way, when Isis found a body part all over the world, all over the kingdoms, she would make a temple. And they, you know, it brought their religion to much worship all over the place. They weren't, Osiris is not just worshipped in Egypt. He was worshipped all over Africa. He was worshipped in Cyprus. He was worshipped in Greece and in Rome and as far as India. Far north, we've just discovered a temple of Osiris in Scotland.
Oh, wow.
I just found this out today. They uncovered a temple to Osiris. Well, it's actually a little further, a little bit south of Scotland, near Northumberland and all of those places. But just before Scotland, probably around Hadrian's Wall, there is this temple that they found to Osiris. And it's amazing. It's written in hieroglyphs and also Celtic runes, which is really interesting. So we know that there's a very strong Egyptian influence there, but also he was followed by the Celts. And I think that's really amazing, coming since that's my heritage, Egyptian and Celts together. Here we are. And I only found out about this about 4 hours ago, and it was just amazing. And I thought, let me add this to my program. So based on what I've said, Hercules, is there anything you have a question about or you want to know more about?
No, you did an excellent job, and you conveyed the information in a very entertaining way with lots of humor, and that was greatly appreciated. I learned much of this years ago, but again, you forget as you fill your brain with other things. So you revived old memories and took me on a trip down memory lane, and I'm greatly appreciative of it. And I learned a few new things as well.
That is my purpose. As a high priest, it's very important for me to be a teacher and to advance our knowledge of the ancestral myths and legends and the worship of these ancient deities, because I believe that they are very much needed in this modern world. People, we're so busy. You see people walking around with their nose stuck in their phones. And they become desensitized. I don't see, you know, they don't pay attention to each other. They bump into each other and they walk. They don't say excuse me. They just walk by, or someone will become offended. And there's a very high energy of anger I've found outside in the world. And I think if we would try to reintroduce ourselves to the God forces, which is something that we're doing now, that it would probably make the world a little better place if we realize that we aren't the be-all to end-all, that, you know, humans didn't create this universe, and humans, if anything, have damaged it, and we've got to fix it. And that is part of the reason I'm doing what I do, to spread the word of positive energy, and from a people that lasted 7 to 10,000 years. Very few other cultures, India, China, the Aboriginals, the Native Americans can say very similar things, but that was a cohesive civilization with cities and rules and care for each other and the accepting of other traditions. This is what drew me from the beginning to the Egyptian society. There were many other temples in Egypt to many other deities, and they didn't say, oh my God, you can't do that here. Other cultures have. They have said that our way is the only way. And I'm not pointing fingers, but we know who I'm talking about. They're all over the world. My way is the only way. And I'm sorry, that's not true. I believe that God, the God force, I call it the All High, the power of all the universe, is seen differently by all peoples. And that how you look at things in a way of beauty and morals and connecting with a higher force than yourself is not wrong. I think that everybody has their own way to look at things. I chose the way of the Kemetic peoples, because it suited me. Hercules is a Greek, and he suit the great Olympians suit him. I have friends that are witches, and their energy suits them. I have people that I know that follow the Buddha, others that follow voodoo. All these different traditions bring one thing, a connection to the God force, the high force, the universal force. And I think that's the most important message we have. And that's, I hope, what you'll all take away from me, that I'm showing you my way, a way that I've learned that gives me peace and tranquility and also peace of mind, a connection to beings outside myself.
Very well said and very powerfully stated, and very much aligned with my philosophy as well. I too share my way, the way that's worked for me, that helps me see and experience the world the way I do, but it's my way. So it might not be somebody else's way. I'll gladly share information if they're curious, and I'll gladly listen to their way as well. But there is no one right way. And that's the beauty of the spiritual path.
I agree completely. And I wanted to say, I know we're probably running out of time soon, but that I am teaching high priests, high priestesses, priests and priestesses, people that will be what I would call tool makers, jewelry makers, musicians, singers, robe makers. These are things that are being taught by the people that I'm working with my temples. If you're interested, we have those doors opening. I start from the beginning, and I am aligned with Hercules. So we are working together, all of us, and we're going to make sure that the positive energy in the world is turned up and excited, and people get, how do I want to say it? People come back to a time when things were a little less angry and chaotic and see the beautiful things in the world still.
And how can people contact you to find out more about this training and then your phone a wizard and all the other great things you're doing?
Because I'm a psychic medium and a trance medium, and I also do various different kinds of readings, including past life regression. You can reach me on my page, Michael K. Waterman's page. There's also Phone a Wizard, which is one of my pages. You can get me on Michael K. Waterman on Facebook. It's the easiest way. I tried Instagram and TikTok and what have you. I find everybody has something to do. I find Facebook is kind of a good, like a market. It's like a green market. Everybody's there, pretty much. You can have me at mkwaterman@icloud.com. That's my little cloud. You can get me on my phone, 516-650-3691. You can also just do my page. You can reach me through Hercules. I will provide for you a reading list and products and things that you need. I have various and assorted candles, oils, incenses, ushabtis, custom ushabtis that I create, which are spirit statues that will help you along your journey.
Setna, thank you so very much. This was an excellent episode and a proud addition to our audio library. We have less than a minute. I'm going to ask you if you would like to be the speaker of Kemet in some upcoming projects. The first one that will be audio is The Roots of Theurgy, where I'm going to have a speaker from the Kemetic tradition, from the Greek tradition, and from the Near Eastern tradition, as these were the roots of what we come to know as theurgy. What we now call theurgy came from these roots.
I would be more than honored, Hercules. I would be more than honored to be the voice of Kemet, the voice of Egypt. I have been all my life that thing, that being. I am the voice of Egypt. Egypt is my soul, and it knows it. And so thank you.
Thank you, and thanks to our wonderful audience, whether you called and you're patiently waiting in our queue, and we have quite a few people tonight, whether you clicked on a link on Facebook or elsewhere and found yourself here, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Thank you very much again, Sedna.
You're very welcome. And to all, life, health, and prosperity, and blessed be.